first, welcome Professor Luke Nottage to join SBS Radio Hmong program, which we're going to talk about the past and the future of Southeast Asia region. So as you are a professor, major in economic integration, investment, and also consumer law of harmonization.
That's right.
And also trade. So what do you think about this Southeast Asian region? What is its future plan? Can it integrate? Can it set up free trade zone like European Union or the other economic zone?
Well, I think the interesting thing from my perspective is that although it's the ASEAN started in the 1960s with a focus on security concerns at the time, especially the rise of communism and what developed into the Vietnam War, the shift has been very much towards economic development and economic integration. And so since the 1990s, we've had the new members, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Myanmar, that have had more authoritarian political regimes, communist regimes even now, some of those countries. But ASEAN has managed to enlarge to include them. And part of the way they've done that is by focusing on the economic integration, common interest. Since those countries have joined ASEAN in the 1990s, after the Asian financial crisis in the late 1990s, and then in early 2000s with the emergence of China joining the WTO and the World Economic Trading System, ASEAN has realized that they need to try some new things in terms of more free trade and investment, especially initially within the region, within Southeast Asia, to be able to have sort of a competitive regional production base to export trade with the rest of the world rather than competition with China. And, you know, they've started quite softly with the 1992 ASEAN Free Trade Agreement, which established a common effective preferential tariff regime for trade within the region. But then they've expanded that. We've heard a lot in recent years about the ASEAN Economic Community Initiative since 2007, which aimed to bring down tariffs completely within ASEAN by the end of 2015. That was as many things ASEAN not fully achieved, but it got pretty close. And the other development has been that ASEAN, from that closer intra-ASEAN economic integration, has managed to conclude some pretty significant free trade agreements as a region with major economies in the Asia-Pacific, especially China, Japan, Korea, India, and, of course, Australia with New Zealand. And that's really helped to further expand their market access and trade and investment flows with their major dialogue partners in the Asian region, broader Asian region. So already with RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, so ASEAN is negotiating already with China, as well as Korea, Japan, India, and Australia, New Zealand. I'm not aware of what is being planned or implemented between ASEAN and Taiwan, but I'm sure, especially if ASEAN negotiates as a whole, rather than each individual member state with Taiwan, you know, they can secure an appropriate sort of agreement and arrangement. So those free trade agreements have built into them some potentially quite effective dispute resolution mechanisms to make sure they're enforced, commitments are enforced if they have to be. So, for example, in relation to investment, all those FTAs with investment chapters that ASEAN has entered into include the possibility of a foreign investor making a claim directly against the host state for discriminatory treatment or not giving fair treatment or denying justice in local courts. So that's a pretty effective, credible mechanism to be able to enforce those sorts of protections for foreign investors and with the aim of encouraging more cross-border FDI. So on the whole, there's been this increasing attention to economic integration, first within ASEAN and then with the rest of the world, and also a shift towards more formal treaty-based mechanisms to try to consolidate that.
Do you think that ASEAN are ready to integrate as one single market? Because in broader term, when we look at the health, education, human capital, and the political democratization, respect the rules of laws and peace and security in this region, all sort of troubles are still in place, and they would like to open a free trade market. At the same time, they are also anti-globalization, anti-free trade, claiming creating inequality for the have-nots and the haves. So do you think that it is possible to do so, as many countries are well prepared, but some of their members are still lacking behind?
It's feasible and also appropriate to have closer economic integration when some countries are less, like Laos, for example, which traditionally hasn't been so integrated in trade networks because it's completely landlocked. Well, I think we find that there's greater recognition in all the ASEAN member states, even the less developed ones, that, you know, there's great opportunities to specialise in products and services that each country has comparative advantages in and then trade them. And there's, you know, more opportunities. So, for example, with China's One Belt, One Road initiative to try and boost infrastructure, connecting up China through Southeast Asia, through Central Asia and so on, there's, you know, great opportunities to expand those sort of trade flows and bring in some even landlocked countries like Laos. So the next question then is, well, how do you deal with adjustment issues that come, you know, when countries try to specialise in goods and services they have a comparative advantage in? And, you know, I think there's growing recognition around the world. We see this in the US in particular recently and so on, that that has to be managed, and there has to be more active government assistance to help companies and employees and so on move out from industries that are no longer competitive into the ones that will be, that are competitive. And so that's a matter of each country's sovereignty and priorities. You know, it becomes a political question, but I think there's more awareness in ASEAN member states as in other countries that's appropriate and has to be done well. The challenge in some of the ASEAN countries is that government systems, both political and bureaucratic, not transparent, so on, and so that process of adjustment can be captured by vested interests and so on. So that has to be done carefully. That's a particular challenge in developing countries, including in Southeast Asia, compared to more developed countries. So that's one answer. The other answer is that I think ASEAN is very aware that they don't want a situation where we open up the borders to trade even further within ASEAN, let alone to the rest of the world, and then everyone dumps their unsafe product, especially on the less developed countries, which, are desperate for the cheaper goods and even has a serious risk of to public health, and that don't have adequate legal regulatory safeguards to prevent unsafe goods coming into the market or deal with them once they appear on the market. And so it's interesting for me to find myself involved in several projects coordinated through the ASEAN Secretariat in the last 3 or 4 years that are trying to harmonize minimum standards of consumer protection law across all the member states. Of course, some countries have had consumer protection statutes and to some degree also quite effective enforcement for several decades. Thailand was one of the first, even in the 1970s, but for example Malaysia and Indonesia since the late 90s have had consumer protection statutes and a reasonable amount of regulatory capacity for enforcement and so on. So that helped consumers benefit from increased trade while also maintaining some minimum standards of protection. But what's interesting for me is to see how the ASEAN Economic Community Project since 2007 has been paralleled with attempts to ensure that less developed member states, including Laos, for example, in 2010, introduce consumer protection statutes and think more about creating a baseline level of consumer protection so that we don't get a situation where the more developed countries in ASEAN or in other parts of the world just dump their products on the less developed countries that don't have regulatory safeguards in place. And of course, there's still a big challenge for just to get these statutes enacted. So some have taken longer than others. Interesting, Brunei, which is a very rich country because thanks to oil and gas and the small population with all those resources, they don't have a proper consumer protection law framework, really. And Cambodia is still in the process of developing a comprehensive statute as well. But as I said, Laos have one since 2010 and Myanmar since 2014. And the big challenge then for those countries is then to make them work more effectively by getting more resources for the regulators, both financial resources and human resources to, you know, carry out the enforcement activities and generate better consumer awareness, get the media involved in reporting about inevitable problems that will always arise with unsafe or goods and defective services. But it's sort of encouraging that we've seen this greater attention even in the developing countries of ASEAN over the last 10 years. Well, I think it is, it has been ready for a while and involved in those networks. I mean, the industry sectors in ASEAN, whether they have foreign investment or not, whether they're indigenous, so for example, the large Thai conglomerates, they're not owned by foreign investors, but they're very active in exporting all around the region and the world. Very sophisticated organizations, very large, and that's been underpinned and led to, you know, the development of those free trade agreements with different parts of the world that I mentioned. So it's already happening, they're already ready, they're already involved. At the government levels, there's more developed or lower middle income ASEAN member states. There's a lot of sophistication amongst those that negotiate those sort of treaties. Yeah, there's still challenges for the less developed ones like Myanmar and I guess Laos and so on in terms of, well, even the lead negotiators of those agreements and so on that promote free trade, but especially for the other government officials that responsibilities in particular areas that can be affected by those trade agreements. So that's the advantage, though, of negotiating those sorts of agreements, not as individual member states, but as part of ASEAN. And so at the moment, for example, we're in the concluding stages of negotiating the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, RCEP, which is ASEAN plus 6 FTA. So, you know, countries like Laos and Myanmar can work with the more experienced negotiators from other developed member states in ASEAN, such as Singapore and so on, to try to get a balanced, effective deal. And there's a lot of scope also to build in flexibilities in those free trade agreements to adjust for peculiarities of those member states. So, for example, in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is not going to go ahead now, it looks like, with the Trump administration, but maybe go ahead without the US or maybe with Trump is no longer president, it might revive. But, for example, Vietnam managed to negotiate some quite considerable exemptions to state-owned enterprises, which are a very important part of their economy as a communist regime still. So, you know, there are those flexibilities you can build in to those regional agreements. But the advantage for the ASEAN agreements is that the developing countries like Laos can share from the expertise of the more developed country.
In terms of peace, security and terrorism in the region, as well as the health and environment, do you think that that might be important factor that might be obstacles for this region's economic integration or economic development into the future?
Obviously, that's a concern, not so much within the region, but with some of the neighbouring countries, including obviously the South China Sea issue. But I can comment on environmental issues. I think those are quite similar to consumer protection issues. I think there's also been more attention paid to the need to make sure that as we have more cross-border trade and investment, we don't see a race to the bottom in terms of environmental standards. And in fact, I think when you look around the region, we've seen improvements in environmental protection standards and also cooperation amongst the member states on some issues. Of course, there are still some tensions, for example, you know, with Indonesia clearing forest areas and haze, you know, then drifting over and blanketing Singapore and parts of Malaysia. And that's always a tension between those countries. But, you know, within each of these ASEAN member states, I think actually not just governments, but also the civil society groups are quite active now. So, for example, in Thailand, ironically, the military government introduced in parliament passed a statute that provides for US-style class actions, so providing collective redress for victims of large-scale damages. So the concept is if you can assemble enough, a minimum number of plaintiffs with a common issues of law and fact or fact, then automatically a class of anyone who is suffering similar damages is brought into the litigation or gets the benefit of the litigation and any compensation orders. And this is potentially very important for enforcing, say, unsafe product issues for consumers, which may be very small scale individually, but affect, you know, hundreds or thousands of individuals. If you don't have an effective mechanism like a class action regime that aggregates those claims, manufacturers and importers won't take so seriously the need to deal in safe products. So it's a very important step in Thailand, I think, quite unique within ASEAN and only in the last couple of years. But interestingly, I've noticed doing some research into the environmental groups that are using this same new class action procedure in Thailand to bring claims in relation to a gold mine operation, actually owned by Australian investors partly. But they're using this new mechanism to challenge that mining operation, arguing that there are adverse health effects, impacts on the local residents. Although the gold mine operator, half owned by Australian investors, is of course arguing that they have different scientific evidence and so on to say that those health impacts are not caused by their mine. So we don't know yet what the Thai courts will say if this class action proceeds. But my point is that we are finding these developments in some ASEAN member states, at least, that make it easier for environmental groups access the court system and influence eventually government policy in that area of environmental protection.
There are concerns about lands concession, lands grabbing, and also it happens in Laos, Cambodia and Vietnam. And plus that aspect, also health issue, and the government also annexed neo-media censorship regulation as well. These could contribute to the leadership management of Asian organization and impede the investment from other regions of the world.
Government authorities giving a long-term concession contract to foreign investors or agribusiness to develop the land for agriculture or for a factory or whatever, leading to environmental issues. Well, that's obviously a concern. So, you know, I think the only solution for that is to, first of all, have transparent processes for awarding those sorts of long-term concession contracts to appropriate foreign investors or local investors. So there shouldn't be discrimination in favour of local vested interests or foreign investors. It should be based on, well, who can do the best job in developing that land appropriately? And it should be a transparent process. We need to have good enforcement of anti-corruption laws, for example. And in many ways, foreign investors nowadays are less likely to be engaged in corruption because, especially if they're from developed countries that have signed up to the OECD Anti-Bribery Convention, their executives involved in corruption and overseas will be subject to criminal sanctions at home. And it's taken a while, but as we've seen in Australia, it's only in recent years that we've seen better enforcement of anti-bribery legislation here in Australia in relation to some activities of Australian investors overseas, including in Southeast Asia. But I think, you know, that's a promising recent development, and so we need to get that aspect right. And then on top of that, we need to make sure that once you've chosen the most appropriate investor or developer, that they stick to the laws of the host state, and those laws of the host state meet minimum standards and are enforced properly and, you know, not subverted by corruption or other issues. And to make sure those laws and the process managed well during the course of development, I think civil society groups and media freedom are essential. And that's why, for example, Thailand is quite a good example within Southeast Asia. They have very active consumer groups and also environmental protection groups and a surprisingly active media, both in traditional media, print and TV, but also lots of social media in Thailand. And although they have quite strict media censorship in relation to anything touching on the royal family, even under a military government, there's quite a lot of criticism that can be expressed quite freely against the military government, as let alone, you know, companies and others. So in that case of the Australian part investor in the gold mine in Thailand, there's quite a vigorous debate within civil society and the media going on about their operations. Some local residents are very active in saying that the gold mine is causing their health problems and, you know, is agitating in the media and approaching politicians in Bangkok. But then there's also another group that says, well, no, we don't think that there's a serious problem here. And so they're going to the media as well and saying, no, we appreciate this local industry. And we shouldn't close it down and so on. And so there's a healthy sign, I think, that there's freedom to express your views. It's assisted, as I say, by now access to the courts to challenge procedures and so on. And so I think less developed countries like Laos, for example, should look closely at how Thailand has managed to create this environment, even though it has a tradition also of authoritarian governments. It has periods when, as you know, there's a military dictatorship essentially, but then it reverts back to democracy and there's another coup and so on. So it's not a sustained democracy. It's a semi-authoritarian state. But nonetheless, it has quite an active media and judicial system.
How important is Southeast Asia region has trade ties with Australia or New Zealand?
I think it's crucial. I mean, for example, in relation to investment, Australian investors have tended to be quite conservative until recent decades. They've tended to invest in other developed countries like the USA. When they invest in Southeast Asia, a lot of that goes to Singapore, although from Singapore, it's hard to track, but some of that investment flows on into neighbouring ASEAN member states. But I think Australians have tended to invest in Singapore because they speak English, it's a more developed country, and it's familiar. Everyone stops off in Singapore in transit. And so, but I think that Australian companies are starting to realise there's a lot of activity and energy in the other more developing member states in ASEAN, and a lot happening, and it's more tightly integrated regionally. And so they're starting to appreciate that there's more potential. So that Australian investor, Kingsgate in Thailand a few years ago, was actually looking to make other investments in other ASEAN countries using the technology and experience they have in Thailand when they started their mining operation in Thailand, but they were looking to get involved in some other countries. And so that's on top of all the trade that we already have with ASEAN, which is in some ways easier to develop than encouraging people to commit long-term investments.
Thank you very much for your time, Professor Luke Nottage.
Thank you.